You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Harry's. Visit harrys.com and you will find out that harrys.com is a shaving company. And if you use the promo code BCS, you can save $5 off your first purchase. The cool thing about this, I'm actually holding the product in my hand. And it's kind of an old school shaving kit. The razor is very fancy looking. You can customize. You can go with the regular handle. You can go with the silver handle. That's what I'm holding. Or you can have a handle engraved. But the cool thing is that you're getting high tempered steel made in Germany. It doesn't dull as quickly as a lot of razor blades. And it's a lot cheaper. And I think what's really cool is they send you all the shaving equipment. So you don't have to go to the drugstore and wait for the guy to unlock the cabinet. That drives me crazy. If you want to get good razor blades, they have them under lock and key because people steal them. And you got to get somebody to come over and unlock it like it's a bar of gold. Then you go and pay $1 million for razor blades. And this with this experience, you can actually get a great shave with a really cool, I'm playing with the head. The head is rubber and kind of molds to fit your body here. I'm turning this into kind of, well, it's a little too erotic, so I'm going to put the razor blade down. But I like the feel of the handle in my hand. And the shaving cream smells really good. All right, enough. The point I'm making is harrys.com is a place you can get quality razors, custom razors, at cheaper than what you would pay for in a drugstore, and they send them to you. You can save time. Who doesn't want to save time and have a great shave? All right? harrys.com. Use the promo code BCS. Save $5 off your first purchase. And now, let's podcast. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Brian Callen Dermot's show, and we have John Durant in-house, who wrote a book called The Paleo Manifesto, and Ancient Wisdom for Lifelong Health, and Hunter is modeling it. Hunter's very excited because we have a studio audience for the first time. We have two people.
Brian, you weren't supposed to say the number. You were supposed to just
we have
a studio audience.
It's a studio audience.
That's right.
A large and growing cult following.
Cult following. Well, John, when I read the book, when I was going to read the book, I thought, all right, I want to talk to somebody who's, you know, I'd heard your name. You'd been recommended a lot, you know, through Twitter from like Rogan fans and stuff. And I said to myself, I know a lot about paleo. I read about diet. I know all this stuff. The book is, you know, it's really, really refreshing and fun when you open the book and you go, well, this isn't a diet book. It's about a lot of other stuff. You know, I learned a great deal, especially the chapter about Moses being the first microbiologist and why certain people are vegans and dilating on the vegan phenomenon.
And those two chapters are both about really the same topic, which is disgust and pathogens. And how important pathogens are to human health throughout history. So we can go more into depth with that. But I knew that when I was pitching publishers on this book, paleo diet books were already out. And I said to them, I would be bored out of my mind if I had to write a diet book. I don't want to give people 30-day meal plans. I don't want to tell them exactly what to eat. I need to write a book that I myself would be interested in reading.
Yeah. So. And you use evolution. We just had Jerry Quinn on. I wrote a book called Why Evolution is True. But the paleo diet makes a lot of sense to me just because you're very good about it in the book. I mean, you just talk about how we've evolved. And how really there are no indigenous people that are vegans, first of all.
Right.
I mean, there are southern Indians. They eat a lot of – they primarily are vegetarian. That goes back to, you know, sort of their religion and things. But
And the first known cases of diabetes were also in India.
I believe it. And by the way, it's a billion people. Would you mind winning one medal in the Olympics? I'm sorry.
I was dating an Indian woman, and we had an ongoing bet in the Olympics about how many medals they would win.
It's amazing. Amazing. Yeah. That's a large gene pool.
Yeah.
It's a great country and with a great people, all due respect. But, you know, but we're talking about being a vegetarian versus, you know, eating meat.
That's the thing I think that is so interesting about this book and the reason why it's not called the Paleo Diet Book, but the Paleo Manifesto is, you know, it really is a testament to the fact that this is research. Like, this is based on the reality of what it is to be a human being as opposed to some other species.
That's really what it's about.
Yeah.
Learning about what it means to be human.
Yeah.
Where we come from, where we are, where we're going.
I thought the skull, when you went and talked to the guy, the paleontologist, about, he showed you all those skulls.
Yeah.
And you looked at the earlier hominids and how good their teeth were. That was a shock to me.
It was amazing. So I got to go on a tour of the Harvard Fossil Archive. And they just have this incredible collection of ancient bones, most of which aren't on display to the public because they're too valuable and rare.
Mm-hmm.
So the head of human evolutionary biology at Harvard, Dan Lieberman, took me on a tour. And he showed me this one skull that's, I think, about 80,000 years old, named School 5. And I got to hold it. And, I mean, talk 80, about...
80,000 years old.
Yeah. Talk about, like, your hands shaking and being nervous to hold something.
Yeah, he said the only rule is you got to hold it with two hands.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And we were holding it over a table. So if it did drop it...
How big was the head?
The size of a human head.
Yeah, okay. Like a human head. Yeah.
Brian, you've held human skulls before.
Yeah, obviously.
After battle.
After battle.
You know, a little smaller than a soccer ball.
Yeah.
It's the best part to eat, actually. It's a delicacy. Where I'm not from, that's a delicacy. Anyway, yeah.
So. But it's it's just amazing. And this guy had a beautiful, not perfect set of teeth, but a beautiful set of teeth. And then we looked at some early farmers and just teeth riddled with cavities, missing teeth, short, 5 feet tall.
And that can be traced, you think, to the fact that when we started, when agriculture came into being, we were able to grow our own food, we were able to grow grasses that were edible, barley and corn and wheat, that those foods are, they break down into glucose, into sugar, much faster than, say, does meat. And that was what contributes to tooth rot and a host of other problems.
We went from a diet of wild salmon and organic blueberries to eating bread and beer all day, every day.
Wow.
So, and our carbohydrate intake shot up. So, mm-hmm. So yeah, that's going to cause a lot of cavities.
Well, I mean, in this country, when Ansel Keys came along in, I think, the 60s and did mm-hmm. the Seven Nation study and
right.
said, essentially, a low-fat, high-fiber diet is the way to go. Animal fat is what causes this epidemic of heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
And so we should all be eating a high-fiber, low-fat diet. And that meant people were eating, you know, and if you look at even today what the federal government recommends as a slimming diet, breakfast should be Special K, skim milk, a banana, and some orange juice.
Right.
What that does is spike your insulin.
It's all carbs.
It's all carbs,
sugar and carbs.
And you get into, not only will you retain fat molecules, but you get into what's called metabolic syndrome. I mean, so we've been sold a bill of goods by a guy who did some shoddy studies on Indian mill workers, etc., Ansel Keys, who had a very powerful speaking voice. And it's amazing how one man can literally take an entire world and send them in the, at least the Western world, and send them in the absolute wrong direction. This whole low-fat phenomenon. You were talking about how farmers used to eat high. I mean, if you look again at the Bantu belt and you look at a lot of these different indigenous cultures, and especially the way farmers ate in this country, it was high fat. It was a high fat diet, wasn't
it? Cream and cheese and butter and
eggs and
right,
and
all
and
that.
Meat.
Those were the most valuable products on the farm because they were nutritionally dense and they mm-hmm. were valuable. Whereas the grains are cheap. And mm-hmm. and the USDA food pyramid is pretty much what you feed to cattle to fatten them up as fast as possible. Wheat, corn, and soy. The base of the food pyramid is grains. And so that's farmers know that if you let cattle just eat grass like they're evolved to eat, they don't fatten up as quickly as if you feed them wheat, corn, and soy.
Mm.
And if you give them tons of antibiotics, which screws with their gut bacteria and causes them to gain weight.
And that's why a lot of times their liver's abscess because they're eating corn, so they have to be fed antibiotics, et cetera. They're in close proximity to each other.
Right. So, yeah, it's filthy, filthy conditions. It's like early cities, all the pathogens in early cities that, you know, when people started living in cities, infectious disease explodes, and it was a huge health problem. And you breed these extremely pathogenic microorganisms, like we're doing today in factory farms.
And which is causing antibiotic-resistant strains of very powerful, you know, E. coli 156, I think, and different things like that. I mean, these pathogens that are very powerful.
And so what ends up happening is because you've made the wrong choice at the beginning, you end up having to have respond to the side effects of that, which then causes even bigger problems, which you then have to respond to and all that sort of stuff.
We're breeding biological weapons.
Yeah.
that are going to come back to haunt us.
So, John, if you had your say and your druthers, how should people eat and how should we farm our food?
Well, first of all, the most important thing for most people isn't even paleo per se. It's avoiding sugar and heavily processed foods. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people, that's fine.
Why is that? Why do we want to avoid sugar and heavily processed foods?
These are the foods that entered the human diet basically since the Industrial Revolution. We are not adapted to them at all. This is Coca-Cola and Twinkies and frozen pizza and Pixie sticks and all that sort of stuff. It rots our teeth. It makes us fat. It increases depression. It feeds. Glucose is the preferred source of fuel of infections and pathogens. So mm-hmm. so we're breeding the wrong type of bacteria in our body, in our stomachs. A lot of these things cause cancer. A lot of cancers are caused by infections. So the evidence that industrially processed food is bad for you or a heavily industrial diet is bad for you is overwhelming. Mm. If you're young and healthy and active, if you generally just eat whole foods, that might be fine for you. Like, I'm okay saying that. Like, people can be healthy and not eat an exact paleo diet.
Sure.
But the next step is, okay, these are the industrial foods that we're not adapted to. The next step is agricultural foods. Well, these are the foods we've only been eating for about 10,000 years since the agricultural revolution. The two main groups are grains and dairy. And a lot of people find that their health improves when they remove them, at least for a time. A lot of people hear about the gluten-free craze and is this a fad or is this not a fad? Well, basically, for the last 50 years, we've been viewing whole grains as nectar of the gods. You couldn't eat too much of them. There's nothing wrong with them, you know.
Yeah.
So that was the wildly biased point of view, outlandish mm-hmm. point of view. And now the paleo perspective says, wait a second, there might be some drawbacks to eating all these grains all the time. And there might be some drawbacks to dairy, depending who you are, whether you're lactose tolerant, how you eat it, what form,
but
stuff like
what
that.
About when people say, well, all of Europe and much of the Middle East have been eating bread forever. And oh, by the way, they've also been eating dairy. So tell the Italians and the French not to eat cheese, for example. Tell the Swiss not to drink milk. What is their health like? Have we done studies on their health? They seem to be healthier than Americans. That might be because they don't eat as much. That might be because the food they're eating tends to be, until very recently, probably less processed.
Yeah.
The breads are heavy and take a while to break down because they're, you know, you can see it, you know,
right.
when you eat some of that bread. What is the answer to those kinds of things? Yogurt seems to be good for you, doesn't it, in some ways, for some people?
Well, it's a probiotic, which more people are realizing is a really good thing. My general stance is I'm a little bit more militant on grains, and I have more flex in my own diet for dairy. I say militant, I mean for me, not for other people. if you come from an ethnic tradition that has been eating certain foods prepared in traditional ways for a very long time, I'm not going to tell you to stop doing that.
Yeah.
So if something is part of your ethnic tradition, it's bringing people together. You know, it's like
pasta,
alcohol.
Pasta and alcohol, yeah.
We didn't drink alcohol in the Paleolithic. I still drink alcohol because it's a social activity, and there are more important things than optimal
health,
strictly speaking, optimal health.
That's right.
So I'm fine with that. I do think that it's very beneficial for people to use paleo as a starting point to say, I'm going to take a month, I'm going to take 2 months and remove grains and dairy as an experiment, see how I feel, get a read on it, and start to reintroduce foods and see how you do with them. So I have more flex on dairy. I eat some full fat, traditional dairy, heavy cream, sour cream.
Raw cheeses and things.
Yeah, some cheeses.
What about raw dairy products versus pasteurized? Well, you talk a little bit about that in your book.
Well, the...
It's unadulterated milk, right? It
right.
tends to be easier to digest because the lactase hasn't been burned off and things? Or?
I'm not completely up to speed on the exact molecular biology of it, but basically the milk industry became very regulated over the last 100 years or so because you had milk production in cities in the middle of Chicago where things were filthy, right?
Yeah.
You had to pasteurize.
Yeah.
So that was appropriate to industrial milk production. Mm-hmm. If you have a small local farmer that is raising animals with enough space, eating the right diet, doing things properly, there's no problem drinking that milk, and people should be allowed to
make their own choice.
To make their own choice, yeah. And to sell it and to drink it.
Mm-hmm.
We can fight about, exactly whether raw milk is beneficial for everybody.
Well, most
or
of
not.
Us are lactose intolerant. Like, I can't drink. As I get older, dairy really does mess with me.
Yeah.
It really does.
Well, there's some interesting science out there that suggests that it may become more important to eat paleo as you get older.
Yeah.
Like, everybody knows that young people can eat almost anything, yeah, and still feel fine,
right,
and that it declines as you get older, and you get older people who sometimes will become lactose intolerant or celiac. My grandmother, mm-hmm, became celiac late in life.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm not getting older, John.
Oh, you're one of those immortals.
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
Oh. Yes, I am. Ever since I read the Paleo Manifesto.
Ancient wisdom for lifelong health.
That's right.
There it is.
Ancient wisdom for immortality.
There it is. Well, that's what I like, though, again, about the book. It is not, it's not promising these things. It's such a well-balanced book. It's actually a history lesson in a lot of ways.
Well,
you
and
talked
I thought,
to Steven Pinker, right? I mean, it wasn't...
Yeah. Well, he was my college thesis advisor.
It's kind of a big deal. Yeah.
Well, it wasn't as glamorous. For some reason, nobody would show up to his office hours.
Wow.
And I think everybody thought his office hours are going to be packed because he's a star professor.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go to his office hours and nobody would be there. So we'd
That's
shoot
amazing.
The shit for 30 minutes.
That's amazing.
That's
you know?
The experience that Brian has with women. It's just like everybody's like, he's so attractive. Yeah. He's probably out of my league.
Yeah.
And then he just ends up incredibly alone.
Just think if I had John's hair, that son of a bitch.
Oh, my God.
That long, those locks, those caveman
Actually,
locks.
Actually, he used to have that bit about the
weave.
Horsehair mane. And I think
sure
John
did.
Has that.
He does.
Yeah.
He looks like the guy I talk about in my stand-up that I'm jealous of.
It's the caveman look.
Yeah, you should carry a guitar with you, my friend. Back.
Did you see that study where carrying a guitar case?
I have no doubt.
You get laid. Yeah, yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Right.
You're not going to, not with a tuba or a flute, but a guitar for sure. You talk a great deal about the psychology of food too. What I find is food is very emotional for people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, man, if you start talking about paleo, you start talking about eating meat, there are vegetarians out there that will just shut you down. And my experience with vegans especially is that they tend to be pretty religious,
yes,
about their diets. And can you talk a little bit about it? Because for the first time, you dilate on it in one of your later chapters. And I was fascinated by it because it primarily belongs to, it's a habit that belongs primarily to young urban women.
Yes.
I hadn't thought of that. And talk a little bit about the psychology and what you hypothesize.
So there's a... People arrive at veganism or vegetarianism for different reasons. So I don't want to generalize about everybody.
You're very sympathetic, by the way.
Yeah.
Which you're very respectful to the idea that some people just don't. What I thought was interesting is that some people don't want to eat an animal because they feel badly for the animal. We've humanized animals.
Right.
But one of the things about, I've done some hunting, and one of the things that you say is when you've been around, when you've butchered animals, when you've hunted animals, you don't feel the same way. You're not grossed out by meat. You
right.
know? I mean, I've shot and skinned and butchered my own deer, and I got some in my freezer, in fact.
Yeah.
And I'm not grossed out by it. And,
right.
and maybe it's because I feel like a hunter.
Right.
Maybe it's because I like thinking of myself. Like the other day, I was with Hunter, and I was like, man, somebody did that to my daughter, I'd cut their head off. And Hunter goes, see, Brian's fake Sicilian, and where he doesn't come from, you don't do that. And I was like, Hunter! I like fostering my image as a New York...
Yeah.
Italian/caveman guy.
Yeah.
Yes, thanks. Don't ever blow my cover like that.
No, but you believe in rule of law, and that's an admirable thing.
Yeah. But
yeah.
Fuck that. But the point is that men have, you say even when men go vegan, they feel a little emasculated. I'm not
right.
a hunter anymore. I'm a gatherer. So talk about that. I'm sorry.
Yes. So first of all, vegans and vegetarians have brought to light ethical abuses in the factory farm system. So I give them credit for that. But the common path to vegetarianism is, first off, empathy towards animals. And you see that women have much more empathy towards other animals than men do.
And probably in general, they have more empathy than men do, right? In terms of empathy for other human beings, empathy for,
more likely to personalize and humanize other things. I mean, there are plenty of situations where women can be cruel.
Yeah.
But has that been done? Studies have been done on that?
Yeah. So studies have been done, for example, on animal testing for medical purposes. Do you support using mice to do research on cancer drugs? And something like 2/3 of men are completely support it, but half of women would be against it, something like that. Don't quote me on the exact numbers.
Yeah.
But there's a big – yeah, it's in there. There's a big empathy gap. But it also means that you start to think of deer as Bambi, and you Disneyfy it. And unfortunately, life is not a Disney movie. And deer aren't humans. And a skilled human hunter is the least painful way for a deer to die.
100%. That's what people don't realize. I was out in Montana and, you know, I dropped my deer in one shot, guys. dropped him. I mean, dead. But the point
one,
is...
One karate
but
chop?
But that is... Yeah, yeah, well, I hunt with a knife. I threw my...
And his
it was my throwing star. It was my throwing star.
He just bit it in the neck.
I blew a poison dart, and then I bit it in the neck. But a high power, I was shooting with a Win Mag 300. That thing dropped that deer. Boom. It just hit the ground. It was dead. And one of the things that you know about deer is the huge winter kills. They just freeze to death and starve to death. I mean, huge kills from the winter.
And the yearlings are the ones most likely to die in the winter. So when there's overpopulation, you have tons of Bambis, little Bambis out there slowly starving to death over a period of weeks.
Yeah.
Painfully, where nobody can see them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But nobody can see them, so people don't care.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It actually sucks being a deer.
Yes.
Your food and hooves, and you should be eaten.
Yeah.
And they're delicious. But anyway.
So step one on the path to veganism and vegetarianism, greater empathy among women than men. The next step is really interesting. Women have a more sensitive disgust reflex than men do. And people throw around the word, ooh, grossed out, yuck, things like that. But disgust is actually being studied scientifically, how it evolved, what its purpose is. And what we've realized is that disgust keeps us away from things that can infect us. Bodily fluids, meat, rotting meat, things that smell like they're rotting, corpses, vermin, insects, things associated with pathogens. So for much of our evolutionary history, women were either pregnant or around small children. And pregnant women and small children are extremely susceptible to infection. So avoiding sources of infection would have been a matter of life and death.
Mm-hmm.
So people sometimes make fun of women. Oh, you have a weak stomach. Well, that's BS. Like women don't have a weak stomach. They have discriminating tastes.
Actually smell. Doesn't estrogen boost your smell sensitivity as well?
I mean, women have a better sense of smell.
Yeah, they do. I noticed that. Like I've been with women. You go into a store and like, smell that, and I'm like, man, it smells like, I don't know, candy.
Right.
You know?
So women are, quote, more easily grossed out, but they have a more sensitive disgust reflex. Well, if men weren't around children, weren't pregnant, and regularly had to butcher animals, anybody who's butchered an animal knows that you have bodily fluids all over you. If you if you puncture the gut, you know, if it's a gut shot animal,
stinks. Oh. Yeah. And you got to be. In fact, when you do that, when you dress an animal like that, which I've done a couple of times, you have to avoid the bladder.
Mm-hmm.
You cut out the colon. You got to cut around the anus actually, and then you pull it out that way. I mean, there's a whole thing. But your hands, when you gut a deer, you are bloody up to your elbows. And you're in the field. There's no way to avoid that. You're covered in bacteria at your elbows, and it does not smell good when you open that stomach or you get a gut shot. That's why you always got to go for the heart or the lungs, which I do. Right below the shoulder.
Yeah.
Keep going, John. Sorry. They call me Deadeye.
So meat, because it spoils faster than plants, is more likely to trigger people's disgust reflex. Blood, the sign of corpses, feet on a chicken, All these things can trigger people's sense of disgust, particularly if they didn't grow up on a farm, if they didn't grow up hunting animals, if they aren't exposed to where animals come from. So women already have more empathy than men. They have a more sensitive disgust reflex that can be triggered by some blood, feet on a chicken. And so meat, it becomes very easy for meat to become the focus of the disgust reflex that says, get this away from me. I don't want to put it in my mouth. I don't want to touch it. I need to stay away from it.
Yeah, and you cite Skinny Bitch, that book, where she says you're going to put a rotting, dead animal in your body. You can see that psychology catching hold very quickly.
It's some of the most vivid parts of that book.
They say that women look for cleanliness in men. They say that one of the things that men shouldn't underestimate is being clean when you meet a woman. That's actually a big deal. And they also talk about how healthcare was ushered in by women in most societies. When women started to develop more rights and more of a voice, that was paired with advances in healthcare. Right. Women are way more concerned about cleanliness for their children than men are. I mean, if you see men live together, dude, yeah. In college, it was three guys. We literally had shit growing in the sink. For real, we had sprouts. Nobody was doing the dishes. I was like, I'm not doing them. We had a contest.
Right.
Two months, we didn't do the dishes. When you're a young dude, you're disgusting.
Yes, yeah.
I'm now getting more careful. I mean, I'm a little bit more clean, but that's, you know.
Well,
anyway.
You're married and.
Yeah. So. I have to. And, you know, it's just a sense of order.
You brush your teeth now, which is a big
step
for you.
That's a big step.
Most of the time. Yeah.
Most of the time.
But he doesn't actually really have to because he eats paleo. And so it's only, you know.
There's no sugar in my mouth.
Yeah, that's
no,
where I draw the line.
No grains.
I'm sorry, but I interrupted you about, you kept going about these.
So step one is more empathy among women. Step two is a more sensitive disgust reflex. And step three is they've realized that the human sense of disgust is very closely tied to our moral beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And this will lead into the religion chapter and Moses the microbiologist. But it's very easy to jump from this grosses me out to this is morally wrong. And we see it all the time with a lot of different things. But if meat is the source of grossness and disgust, then it also becomes a moral issue. It becomes a black and white issue where
meat is murder.
Meat is murder, and it's not something you can compromise on. It's a moral belief, and you're either with us or you're against us.
Yeah.
And that's what leads, in my view, according to this, to an us versus them mentality that can be off-putting. But it also attracts true believers.
It really does.
Yeah.
Meat consumption is going up because it's cheaper.
Yeah.
And most of us are not vegans.
Yeah.
Human beings like their meat.
Yeah.
You know.
We're omnivores.
Yeah, and I think that's the interesting thing as well. I mean, you referenced Jonathan Haidt in the book,
right,
who we had on the podcast. And yeah, so much of it is that disgust is, you know, the emotion that leads to genocide. Disgust is the emotion around religion around which religion is often formed, and that's the thing. So, you know, from a scientific standpoint, there's a lot to be said for the idea that vegetarian and veganism are religions. They have a full worldview. They have, you know, insiders and outsiders. You know, there's often, I mean, I think that's what's also interesting. There's almost a sort of a revelation aspect of like this perfect world that we're building towards when everybody will be a vegetarian or a vegan and like that it will solve all of our problems,
right.
You know.
Well, and there are major religions like Buddhism and being, you know, if you're a Jain, if you're a Hindu many different sects that being a Hindu, I mean, most Hindus and certainly Sikhs and stuff. They are vegetarian.
Well,
they have dairy. Yeah,
they have dairy. They so do.
And I think eggs, and they cook with ghee.
Right.
So you're right. They're not strict vegans. But there are.
But it is interesting as well in the sense that they use ghee and things like that, and they use animal products. So it's not that it's about
animals. They can
animals.
Milk an animal. Yeah,
absolutely.
They just won't kill it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They won't kill it. But ghee, to get ghee, I mean, you know, yeah.
It's clarified butter, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to get ghee, you have to go to Amazon, I think.
Something like that.
Yeah. You got to click on your mouth.
Yeah, that's right.
One of the more fascinating chapters of this book, man, that kind of blew my mind, and I had read the Old Testament, and I used to make fun of the book of Leviticus. In fact, the fundamental difference between this radical rabbi, Jesus Christ, and the other, you know, rabbis of his tradition— this Jew comes along and says, by the way, the book of Leviticus, you can throw it out. Because if you read the book of Leviticus, my God, it is just painstaking. How to quarter a calf, how to wash your hands, the ritual around food. You cannot eat an osprey. You cannot eat animals
vermin.
With paws and
yeah.
vermin. And if you talk to hunters, if you eat a bear, you better cook that bear really well. And the reason is because bears carry trichinosis and a whole bunch of other parasites because they eat rotting flesh. You try to eat a bear rare, see you later. And it better be a bear that lives in the mountains and eats only berries and certain time of year, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the same goes with trying to eat a mountain lion. I mean, mountain lions, the flesh is really tough. I've talked to hunters that do this stuff. So talk a little bit about that, because I thought it was a brilliant part of the book. And then talk about Christ being the first dirty hippie.
So if most people, whether they're believers or atheists or agnostics or what, have not actually read the first five books of the Bible cover to cover.
Hmm. I have. That's why you tune in.
Rabbi Callen over here.
Keep going.
So when you do read it, particularly after Genesis, these people are grossed out by everything. There are all sorts of rules, 613 rules, that govern Jewish conduct. And
613. Wow.
So the notion of something being Talmudic, being sort of obscure and arguing over it all the time, comes from Jewish rabbis debating what these 613 rules are and how for them to be applied. Now, about 15 to 20% of these rules concern purity and cleanliness.
Restriction.
Yes. So things like you were talking about, which animals you can eat, washing your hands, bodily fluids. Now, if you imagine yourself living back 3,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago in an early city or on the edges of one, it would have been an absolutely filthy place. People didn't know that germs existed. I mean, the germ theory of disease wasn't discovered until the late 19th century. This is completely new knowledge. And, germs are invisible and they spread very easily. They can spread via the water supply, physical contact. You know, I can drink out of this water bottle, and if someone drinks after me, they can get something.
And that, by the way, carried on through the developing world. I mean, that's finally caught hold. But mm-hmm. There are still parts of the world.
In large parts of the world, it hasn't. I mean, you walk through the slums or favelas, like, yeah. There's trash everywhere. Yeah, doctors often don't wash their hands
enough.
Like routinely.
Yeah.
When I was in Indonesia, I was with the Dayaks. We went into the bush and there was this village that had very little contact with the outside world. And I remember them washing their dishes in dirty pond water. And they would serve it and then they washed it in the dirty pond water. And I went, I was like, they're washing those dishes in that dirty pond water that's full of parasites. And Biruti Galdikas, who was the woman of the red apes, who was like Jane Goodall of orangutans, I was doing an Earthwatch thing. And she said, you can't see germs. You tell them that.
Yeah.
They just hadn't been exposed to it.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and even today.
Europeans, but you know.
Right.
There's a great book by Everett Rogers called The Diffusion of Innovations. And one of the things that he talks about is that often, like, for example, boiling water or very simple interventions like that.
Yeah.
What they don't take into account are existing beliefs of disease or existing beliefs about this sort of stuff. And, you know, from a native person's perspective, you know, if you believe that, for example,
that vaccines cause disease
or whatever,
like that.
Or you believe, yeah. you're essentially coming along and saying there are these invisible creatures that you can't see. And if you boil water but then let it cool down, somehow they're dead.
Yeah.
Like, it's pretty crazy sounding.
Well,
it sounds like crazy mythology.
Today, look, the protease inhibitors, Matthias Rath took out full-page ads in South Africa and got the president, Thabo Mbeki, to actually endorse the fact that retroviral drugs were causing AIDS and stopped that therapy for tens of thousands of HIV-positive people or even more than that. And that held sway. And we're talking about in the 90s or was it 2000?
So these
prejudice and superstitions carry
through. Well, and you remember what Mbeki's successor said, right? he basically had sex with a prostitute and then basically went on national TV and says, "Don't worry, South Africa, I don't have HIV because I took a shower afterwards."
There you go.
You know? There you go. I mean, that's really a message you want to be spreading
but
to people.
It's all too human, and, yeah, and history is full of that, and it's very, very easy. But so we keep interrupting you.
No. So so say you're back then. You don't know that germs exist. Mm-hmm. Infectious disease is exploding, and it's the number one cause of mortality. And people literally just get sick and drop dead, and nobody knows why. So, of course, back then, people dropping dead mysteriously, they attribute it to the gods, mm-hmm, or the god. And these people, for some reason, unknown reason, are being punished. It looks like they're being punished. They're actually just getting infected and dying. But, you know, say that prostitutes end up getting sick and dying a lot. It looks like they're being punished by God. Mm. But in reality, they're contracting pathogens because they're having sex with a lot of partners. There are no condoms. There's no, like, health testing or anything like that. And so it looks like they're evil people when in reality they're contracting diseases that are killing them. So if you – the early notions of sin, we've completely forgotten the origins of sin. The early notions of sin in the Bible are very closely tied to hygiene and cleanliness. So things like staying away from bodily fluids. Any type of sex was considered unclean. There were certain types of, you know.
Well, when they would conquer, you said, I forgot about this, but I think in Deuteronomy, when you conquer a people, they kill everybody but the virgins. You could have sex with the virgins because they learned from their mistake when they conquered. They had sex with all the women and they contracted all these diseases.
Right. So and it was the diseases supposedly were punished, was punishment by God.
Yeah, right. But somehow they figured out that so virgins were okay to have sex with. God, that's so brutal.
Well, but that's also, I mean, in terms of our discussion about religion, like that insight that what they're really doing is microbiology is a huge, huge insight, because so often people look at the Old Testament and they see the stuff that seems brutal, murder everybody but the virgins, and they're like, look at how patriarchal this society right. is and all of this sort of stuff. And it has nothing to do with patriarchy, or it's a side benefit for the patriarchy. Like mostly it's really about disease.
Exactly. And if you have... So if sin mm-hmm. is defined as something unhygienic, mm-hmm. tattooing, cannibalism, mm-hmm. sacred prostitution, mm-hmm. Eating animals that died of their own accord because those are likely to be
drinking blood,
all these things. If those things are defined as sinful, then the people who sin will be more likely to die, look like they're being punished. And if you have a group of people like the early Jews or early Israelites, who follow a scientifically sound hygiene code, or a hygiene code that's mostly scientific.
It was scientific, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Animals that were killed by another animal, you didn't eat that, and they yeah. washed incessantly. They boiled and cleaned the enemy's linens and pots,
right.
or burn yeah. things to the ground because they were even touching them.
My favorite is always the one about how if your plates get touched by non-kosher food, you have to take them out into the yard and bury them. And, you know, that seems like ridiculous in a modern context, but what you understand is, oh, no, wait, it's actually incredibly sound microbiology with the technology they had available.
Yeah, it's got a bunch of salmonella on it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you fucking bury that shit.
And it doesn't mean that every rule was scientific or right, mm-hmm. and it doesn't mean and some of them may have gone way too far.
Right.
But a hypersensitivity to potential vectors of disease would have been beneficial. Because that was the number one cause of mortality. So if you get a group of people like the early Jews who followed a scientifically sound hygiene code, hand washing, bathing, food inspection rules, avoiding bodily fluids, traditional sexual codes, they will die less often than infectious disease, and it will look like they're favored by God.
Yeah.
It'll look like they're the chosen ones.
Wow.
And
so God's chosen people are scientists.
That's a big jump there, Hunter.
Yeah.
I have a line in there saying that the Jewish God was science.
Yeah.
And the Jewish God has been known for being different than other gods. Mm-hmm. Faceless, abstract, rule bound.
Couldn't even say his name. I mean, Yahweh was considered was to trample on orthodox sensibilities. Even to utter his name was to define him.
Right.
And so he was, I am who I am. I think he
says. Yeah, and you couldn't have an image, yeah. an idol representing.
When he says to Moses, he says something to the effect, yeah. it's a parable. I am who I am or whatever. And it's like,
no, he says his name is I am. It's I simply am. That he exists.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and yeah. I do that sometimes
baller.
Too.
Yeah.
It never has the same goddamn effect.
But you'll also yeah. notice that this also tells us that Brian is not afraid of God. Like, he's willing to say
well,
his name.
Well, honestly, not to be, I shouldn't say this on this podcast, but I always hear him once in a while, like in the morning, a lot of times I don't know if it's him, but I always hear, you're my favorite. I don't know if that's.
So if you're his favorite, you'd have my hair.
Right. Yeah. But one of the oh. radical notions I never thought about was that Christ comes along
right.
and he says, wait a minute. We don't, that all this bathing, washing your hands, it's ridiculous.
All these rituals.
Let's simplify it. All these rituals, you're never going to expand the religion. Nobody wants to be part of this weird group that does these things. Keep it simple, stupid. And he said, you don't have to wash your hands. That's not part of our tradition. Just hold, you know, you basically do unto others as you have them do unto you and hold God as your only God. Be a monotheist and you'll be fine. Guess what? It kind of ushered in tradition of...
It basically, the hygiene laws got dropped in Christianity. All these Levitical rules, even just take hand washing. One of the disputes that Jesus had with the Pharisees, and it's in three of the Gospels, I believe Matthew, Mark, and Luke, was over hand washing. And Jesus and his followers didn't wash their hands before eating. And this broke one of the Mosaic laws or an interpretation of it. And so Jesus, as this young upstart, says that rule is not important. You guys are so obsessed with what you're touching, your dishes, your dishware, the exact food that you eat, being circumcised, all these things. It makes it difficult to spread the good word if you've
got to go through this boot camp.
Yeah, you've got to learn 613 rules and what to wear and this. Yeah. You know, you got to be circumcised, and if you're an adult, you have to be circumcised while you're an adult, like with no
anesthetic.
Yeah. not pleasant.
Yeah.
So he basically jettisons the entire purity code and takes a fundamentally Jewish moral principle, which is love your neighbor, and universalizes it. So rather than this moral principle just applying to the people in the tribe, he says, let's apply it to everybody. But what's holding us back are all these hygiene rules that says you basically can't go...
You can't be a Jew unless you do these.
And it also, this also makes a lot of sense in terms of why the Jews were so upset about him preaching to the Gentiles, because the Gentiles were disgusting.
Were dirty.
Quite literally, right. They were unclean.
So the story of the leper touching Jesus and being healed...
By the way, nobody in this podcast talking is Jewish.
Yeah. I just looked Jewish.
It sounds like we're at... Brunei birth or something.
I've had this chapter read by a number of Jewish scholars, so it's
awesome.
It checks out.
Yeah.
But in Jesus' interaction with the leper, it's not simply that he had magical powers that healed the leper. It's that under the Mosaic law, you were not allowed to touch lepers.
Mm. Yeah.
And then you became dirty as a result. So
you can catch leprosy by prolonged exposure to lepers. It's a slow-moving microbe, but I've seen leprosy with my own eyes, and I've seen advanced leprosy. Because I spent enough time in Yemen and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and India as a kid back in the 70s and early 80s. I saw you know, people with no hands and no noses. It sucks, man. That's a really fucking bad disease. I mean, you'd want anything but leprosy. It's slow, and you are a leper. You are an outcast because it is contagious. You can be around it, and you will catch it if you're around it long enough. So a lot of the missionaries that worked with lepers would come down with leprosy.
Yeah. Well, and someone like Mother Teresa, who goes into filthy slums in India... I mean, that's similar. She, you know, if you're a part of the Brahmin caste, part of your basically religion in Hinduism is you don't touch the untouchables.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so in a similar way, she was saying, forget the hygiene stuff. Forget not being allowed to touch people who do dirty jobs or people who are filthy or infected. I'm going to go to them. I'm going to touch them, and I'm going to help them. So in an interesting way, I think Jesus was right and Jesus was wrong. He was wrong in a sense that hand washing is an important thing.
He wasn't very scientific.
Yeah. Right. But he was right in that he actually was spreading a moral principle to everybody, saying you actually should love everyone. So that's why I call him the original dirty hippie.
it was really, really illuminating.
And also,
really
I thought
fascinating.
It was also fascinating in terms of the knock-on consequences of that for the Black Death, because what you were saying in terms of how that led to the persecution of the Jews and all of that stuff.
Yeah, so in the 15th century, the Black Death, bubonic plague, comes from Central Asia, spreads through Europe. About a third of Europeans die. I mean, can you just imagine a third of Americans dying?
Yeah,
it's just
and
insane.
And some parts, half the city would, you know, just perish.
So Jews got blamed for the Black Death. They got scapegoated. It was said that they were putting poison in wells. But people. There were rumors going around that Jews weren't dying as often from the Black Death as Christians were. And for much of history, historians have basically written off that idea because it sounds like it motivated genocide and persecution. But if the Jewish people back then were washing their hands, bathing, protecting their water supply, avoiding insects and vermin, which was the vector by which bubonic plague spread, then they would have been dying less often.
And probably had tight-knit communities and avoided contact with a lot of other people.
Yeah, they were often in their own ghetto.
Yeah.
And they would, this is actually in documents, they would cover their wells because they cared about the purity of their water supply. Well, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
That's exactly what you want to do if you want to avoid the Black Death.
Yeah.
But that was used as evidence that they were poisoning other wells, but they had kept covers on theirs to prevent them from being poisoned.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the rationale was completely wrong, but you know, there have been rumors of Jews surviving plagues and pestilence, not just in the Black Death, but for many hundreds of years afterwards. And then there's good scientific data that's been published in top journals and is completely credible, showing that in the late 19th century and early 20th century, Jews tended to live about 5 to 10 years longer than neighboring Gentiles, primarily due to a lower disease burden.
Yeah. Yeah. And infection causes such a whole host of, I mean, when a pathogen enters your body, a microbe, you were talking about how it is the conduit for so many different, including things like schizophrenia, maybe.
Yeah.
You know?
Potential mental issues, cancer, all sorts of stuff.
If I gave you, I put you on a desert island. I gave you five foods. let's break it down. I give you three foods, and then we're going to keep going.
Yeah.
So I give you three foods. What are they?
Well, are we assuming that I'm not catching my own fish there?
Because I think I wouldn't
fish?
Assume
we're,
that
we're
based
assuming
on...
you're not catching your own fish.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I'd take fish.
Fish.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would take. I mean, they would be all animal foods because they're
really.
Huh. Well, just in terms of nutrition,
yeah.
I would rather have animal foods available than a particular plant.
Okay.
So I would take fish. I would probably take a whole cow or lamb, fish, lamb. And maybe some and duck.
Oh,
so
nice.
you take three animals.
I would take three animals. Here's why.
Could you live on that?
Sure. People have lived on all meat diets. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Some stranded explorers in Antarctica lived on seals and walrus.
Well,
and,
I guess
and
the Inuit
like
basically
in
are.
Yeah. But you have to eat. You have to eat nose to tail. You have to eat all of the animals.
That's right.
Because there was, what was it, rabbit fever or rabbit starvation?
Rabbit starvation.
Yeah.
They don't have any
you
fat.
Need fat.
Yeah.
You got to have fat.
Well, but you have to eat essentially the offal, the intestines, the liver, all that.
I'm not
so.
Picking that out of enjoyment. I would much rather have more diversity in my diet and plants.
Yeah, because I would have said fish, sweet potatoes, and avocado. Can I live on that?
Yeah, you could live on that.
Yeah.
You could live on that.
I mean, it feels like it's healthier than an all-meat diet. Because I got my protein. I got my vitamin, all my vitamins from the tuber. From sweet potatoes, I hear, are very high in all different kinds of things like vitamin C and A and all that. Aren't they? I don't know.
So they're as roots and tubers go, they're good. But they have a high energy content.
Right.
But here's the thing, is with plants, eating one plant over and over and over again.
Builds toxicity.
It builds toxicity, and that can be a problem. So if I had a diversity of plants, that would be fantastic. Okay. But, you know, if plants contain naturally occurring toxins and poisons, the ones that are in – because they can't run away from predators. So an herbivore, an insect, comes along and just starts nibbling on a plant. Well, a plant, that's not in its evolutionary interest to be devoured by another species. So they're nature's chemists, and they use chemical warfare to fight back. So plants have just a huge chemical diversity. They're the source of our medicines. They're the source of our poisons. Mm. They can be really good. They can be really bad. It depends on which one and how it's prepared. And how much you have of it.
So, what are the best vegetables to eat on a daily basis? What happened to our daily vegetables?
Oh, you know, kale is great. Kale is just loaded.
But you can overeat kale too, right? I mean, there are people who have gone nuts eating kale.
You want to cook it. I heard about a woman who ate raw bok choy all day, every day, and then got some sort of...
Toxicity
problem. Yeah. For most of the things in the grocery store, you know, they've been domesticated. They're not as toxic as their wild versions.
They're more nutritious.
Right.
Like that,
yeah. Right.
Like cassava and manioc are like crazy. They have all sorts of cyanide in them, and you have to cook them properly.
Oh, cassava. If you don't cook it, you'll die. Yeah.
Right.
You can't mess around with that.
So, but a lot of plants, wild plants, are like that. So if I just had to eat the one same plant over and over again, I'd be more hesitant about that than eating the same.
But if you
want
to be an athlete, so I give you, so now I give you five foods. What are they?
Five foods. Okay. So we'll,
I'm bringing butter, just so you know.
Yeah. Butter would be good. Coconut.
Coconut's good.
Coconut's good. I would add I would probably add sweet potatoes. I would add maybe... I like the pick of avocado and kale. See, if I had five, I might scale. I might not take three animals. I might then just have fish and lamb, and then have three plants. Now that I can eat
you like
them.
Lamb more than you like beef.
Well, lamb, if you buy it, it's more likely to be grass fed and raised properly. Okay. I do like lamb. Do I like it more than beef?
I'm just saying, healthier wise. Yeah, so it's not going to be corn fed. It's probably going to be grass fed.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I do like eating lamb more than beef, but it might also because I don't eat it every, you know, frequently.
If you want, let's say you do CrossFit.
Yeah.
And I know that Craig Glassman talks about the zone diet as really probably being the best. I mean, it's essentially not a low carbohydrate diet, but you get your carbs from,
right.
You know, you get your fats from, you know, good sources, and you get your carbohydrates from berries and vegetables and very little bread, in fact. So it is kind of close to the paleo diet.
Yeah, well, they're pro paleo.
Very much.
Yeah,
so.
They're very much so. I mean, they're CrossFit and paleo.
And
so
I appreciate that because they've done real experiments. They have a large test group, and there's a real orthodoxy to CrossFitters, but they are in some great shape, and they have both endurance and strength, and a lot of them are strict paleo. And it seems to really work. They look pretty healthy to me. I wouldn't mind looking like the average CrossFitter.
I was out at the CrossFit Games last year, and there were probably 20-some thousand people there. I have never been in such a large group of people where I wanted to have sex with nearly everyone.
I know. I know. They're all beautiful.
It was just people had... It was Southern California. Nobody was wearing any clothes.
Forget it. Including the men. I'm straight, and I'm like, oh, I thought I was straight.
Yeah.
This is crazy. Yeah, I was just at a jiu-jitsu tournament in Matamoros, and it's the same thing. Like, just these Brazilian women and men walking around. I was like... Why don't we just... Everybody should just be having sex. Yeah. What's with the jiu-jitsu? Let's just...
Yeah, make love, not war.
Right. I'd love to be involved. I'll hold a video camera.
Well, but what I do like about CrossFit is they let individual boxes decide what to promote. You know, they don't... As much as there's a very much a single sort of view of CrossFit in terms of exercise... you know, if boxes want to promote the zone or other things, they're free to do that. So
yeah.
Well, and in general, I mean, that's the thing about CrossFit too. It's so customized. You know, if you're like, they allow you to, you know, really tailor your own program. The main thing to focus on is on diversity of movement, right? Not doing the same thing
functional,
over and over again. Yeah. And functional fitness. Yeah.
What do you eat? What do you eat typically?
So I'm
breakfast. What's your breakfast?
So breakfast this morning, I had. Five pieces of bacon, three eggs sunny side up, a bunch of broccoli.
What do you cook your eggs in?
I cook them in the bacon fat. But I'll cook in coconut oil, olive oil, mm-hmm. ghee, butter. Those are my go-to cooking cooking oils. And I'll sometimes just steam some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But
you had broccoli.
Then a bunch of broccoli cooked in the bacon fat and a few pickles and a cup of coffee with a little bit of heavy cream. Mm. So I flex a little bit more on dairy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fairly strict on grains, though when I do eat grains, I'll be more likely to eat rice.
Mm-hmm.
Like white rice,
white rice, you're not so mad at.
White rice is just carbohydrate. So if you want more carbohydrate in your diet, eat it.
Yeah.
And I like the texture. I like sushi. It soaks up sauces, and it gives me sort of an option when I'm out. So I'm active. I'm probably a little bit more low carb than I should be. I'd like to put on some weight and have it more. So white rice is a good option for that.
Mm-hmm. What about for lunch?
Well, I often have about two meals a day. I'll have like a late breakfast, early lunch, and then sort of a dinner around 7 or 8. But lunch typically would be a chef salad, a Cobb salad, you know, some sort of salad with meat on it, or sushi, mm-hmm. or like a Mongolian barbecue, meat and vegetables type stuff. But I tend to have lighter lunches because if I eat too much, particularly carbohydrate, I get sleepy.
Yeah.
So it's protein and fat for lunch.
Well, that's the thing about Europe traditionally, in Spain and Italy, and you know, you in Greece, you took a siesta. After lunch, man, you had a 2-hour siesta. I mean,
we need to bring the nap back.
I think so. What
actually, Russell Foster. I mean, we had Russell Foster, who is an Oxford sleep scientist, and he was saying, like, yes, we do need to bring the nap back. There's a lot, you know,
waking up later for teenagers.
Yeah, and
school
yeah.
should start.
Yes.
This.
That's right. And yes. he was also talking about historically, people used to sleep in two shifts. You would sleep for, you know, a number of hours, wake up in the middle of the night, go around, walk around, you know, do whatever, and then go back to sleep and have a second sleep.
That's never coming back.
Yeah, exactly.
Those days are done.
Yeah, exactly.
But what about the idea of eating carbs at night, protein in the morning? What is that? Have you done any research on that?
You know, I can't draw on the scientific literature for that. I just know that personally, I am more clear-headed when I minimize carbs in the morning.
Yeah.
And so protein and fat heavy in the morning, and then I'll have more carbs at night when I don't have to focus quite so much.
Right.
But if I've just worked out, I can eat more carbs, and it doesn't affect my concentration.
I think what's really interesting about this book, and it actually is sort of a theme of what we deal with, is that so often books deal with the what, right? So if you think about a traditional diet book, it's like eat this, don't eat this, and all of that sort of stuff. But as human beings, we need meaning. We need the why answered.
So true.
Yes.
And, you know, that's what this book does so well, because it's so interdisciplinary. You're drawing on anthropology. You're drawing on history. You're drawing on, you know, religion. You're making sense of things for us. And so, you know, in terms of being able to stick to these things, you know, I think if you get the why in place, you're much more likely to, because then you have a complete worldview, a rationale, and all that sort of stuff, and you're more likely to follow through.
All the scientific papers and mm-hmm. recommendations in the world mean nothing if people aren't motivated to make healthy choices. They mean nothing, absolutely nothing. You can flush them down the toilet.
Right.
That's exactly right.
And so that's actually what I love most about CrossFit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we can talk about high interval training and functional movements and all sorts of stuff like that. But they turned it into a sport. They learned how to motivate a certain type of person
mm-hmm.
by putting your name on the board, by competition, camaraderie, having a sense of identity in your CrossFit box. That's and MMA. I mean, look at the rise of MMA. You know, it stripped away the artifice, the artistic nature of a lot of martial arts, and made it about functional, purposeful movement, meaningful movement.
Your kung fu is no good in my school. That's what it is. Yeah,
yeah.
Meaningful movements mm-hmm. that have a purpose.
Yeah.
Right.
And that motivates people. Purpose
right.
motivates people.
Because
and
people
that's,
need meaning.
Right.
We're not, that's what makes us different from machines.
I was so biased because reading the book, I truly felt like I was already converted. I mean, everything you talk about, like mixed martial arts, these are all my passions.
Right.
Eating well, I mean,
right.
forget it. But But what I thought was really cool, again, about the book was I learned two very important things. And, you know, Hunter and I read a lot of books on this podcast, and we have a lot of great authors. But one of the things that you know is that typically when you read a book, there aren't a lot of new ideas out there. I mean, you'll read a book, and they're giving you a history lesson. But if you have a command of history, you have the command of the big ideas, you can tend to, you know, you can kind of go, yes, 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 yes. And he's getting to a larger point. He's framing it, and he's coming to his point. And you can kind of, that's how you can start to read books sometimes. You don't have to read them as carefully. But this book, for me, you know, those two chapters, especially on where veganism, with the, sort of the psychology,
was
fascinating.
The religion chapter was how a religion actually had a health function. And the veganism chapter was how a health movement actually functioned like a religion.
And it's also
fascinating.
And I think that's the thing.
We should mention Islam, by the way. I'm sorry, but Islam is also very much takes on from
halal,
the tradition.
Yeah.
Right.
It takes from the tradition of the Old Testament. I mean, you do bathe five times a day. I mean, they have a lot of rules about cleanliness and how to behave.
And you can think about hand washing before prayer. Perhaps it's not that hand washing emerged. Perhaps it's not that people wash their hands in order to pray. Mm-hmm. Perhaps it's that prayer emerged as a mechanism to get people to wash their hands.
Maybe. They wash their feet and their hands.
Right.
They take their shoes off before they walk into the mosque.
Although,
so these,
by the
all
way,
these things.
Just as a comment, my parents live in Libya, and sometimes it ends up working the opposite way, because often if you're like an old man and it's Ramadan or whatever, the only way that you can wash your feet, because you can't get them up to the sink, is by sticking your feet in the toilet. So sometimes now in a modern context, yeah, they all the time they find out that like these old men.
Well,
are sticking
that's an old dude.
Yeah,
but, I mean,
bathing in the Ganges.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Know, that tradition almost certainly emerged to help people get clean. But then once 100 million people
and burying their dead, 100 million people in the
and
dead
urinating
in the
and
yeah, corpses and things like
exactly.
that.
The Ganges is not the cleanest river. You wouldn't want to be an Indian dolphin. Is all I'm trying to say.
Exactly.
All due respect to the Ganges and all the Indians. You don't want to be a fucking dolphin because they get warts.
And if you go to the convenience store and you find that now they're trying to sell, you know, a new mineral water called Ganges.
Don't touch that. What's
shit?
With the dolphin coughing? Looks like it's got cholera. It's because it lives in the Ganges.
It's got probiotics.
That's my New Yorker in India.
Yeah.
John Durant, you are a gem. What are you working on next?
I'm figuring that out right now. I'm exploring a few things. A healthy food company for kids to try to get kids to actually eat healthy food.
I'll invest. I promise.
All right.
I will go into business with you. I thought your book was illuminating, and I know
it's brilliant. And that's the thing. I mean, you know, so much of what we look for on this show are big ideas.
Yeah.
And that's what's so cool is that, I mean, even as you're talking about all this stuff, I'm now thinking – it gives you a whole new perspective on the Hindu caste system. The thing that you said, by the way, as well about, you know, why in hot places they eat spicy foods, that it's a natural form of disinfectant.
Right.
Like, that's brilliant. I mean, you know, especially because Rajasthani food, you know, it's like so hot there, both the food and the climate, and it makes a lot of sense.
What I love about this topic is that we could just keep going on
talking
about it.
You're like, oh, fascinating.
It's a huge part of life.
Right.
But the book, in that sense, is very fair. You're so fair.
Yeah.
You back it up with all the science. You talk about evolution. There's just a lot that I really
And even what you said about as well about veganism, that often it's actually a very healthy choice for people who have a history of eating disorders, a way for them to be able to, instead of being bulimic or anorexic, they become vegan.
Yeah.
And
most vegetarians, it's true, like, you will find a history of eating disorders.
Yeah.
I mean, I've done my own knocking. I mean, I haven't done any scientific studies, so I'm generalizing, and I don't want to be unfair.
But Brian has slept with a lot of vegans.
I sure have. I like carnivores. I've always been women that are, I like the CrossFit.
Same.
Yeah, it's that gets me. John Durant, thanks for joining the Brian Callen Hunter Motz Experience.
Oh, it's upgraded to an experience.
I want to change the name of the show.
I don't like the Brian Callen Show.
It's so annoying, the Brian Callen Show. It's not a show. I need another name, man. I'm slowly trying to change this. I want to call it the Motz Callen Experience.
Well, but I think Joe Rogan already has the Joe Rogan Experience.
I know. And Joe's the one who said, call it the Brian Callen Show. It's a great name.
Why don't we crowdsource this? Let's crowdsource this.
All right.
Right? So
tweet
if
us.
You have a better name for the show, tweet Brian and I.
Yeah, and you'll get a free signed copy of the Paleo Manifesto.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. Oh, damn, incentive.
It's a hell of a
promotion.
It's a hell of a book. We're going to feature it on the podcast, on the website, and I'm going to call Joe Rogan. He's got to get you on.
Yes, he does.
Fascinating.
Do you like speaking to a million people at a time?
I do.
All right, I'm actually gonna send Joe a text right now. All right, everybody, thank you so much for joining. If you want to know where I'm doing stand up, who wouldn't? Just go to BrianCallen.com. I'm all over the world. And by world, I mean the United States and Canada,
which is the world, right?
Yeah. Exactly. All right, guys.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to BrianCallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.